Okay, everybody, if we could settle down. Welcome to this LSE Ideas event for this particular evening. People, profits and peace, human security, the private sector, I'm just making sure I'm getting it right, and the SDGs. Just two or three quick announcements. One, to say who I am. My name is Professor Michael Cox, or Mick Cox. I'm a director of LSE Ideas. Now I've got a co-conspirator in the shape of a man called Professor Christopher Coker. So there's two of us. And we run LSE Ideas together. And within LSE Ideas, we run several programs. One of the most successful and one of the most important to us is this, which Dr. Mary Martin runs on the United Nations. LSE Ideas, for those of you who don't know, but I'm going to tell you now very briefly, has been in existence for just about 10 years. We both function as a research centre within the LSE, and many thanks to the LSE for all the support it's given us over the years, lending us its names, amongst other things. And this most important of institutions in the social sciences within the world. And also, we function as a think tank within a larger think tank world. Don't ask me what a think tank is. The basic things we're supposed to think. And then hopefully provide unbiased, objective information about the world as it is. And as you know, we're living in a world where people are not believing their facts. Last week, we held a session precisely on that, about how do we communicate information, A, in a highly competitive information environment, and secondly, how do we convey information in a world where there's so much disinformation? And so that's one of the things we do, and I've long associated with Ideas and hope to be continue to do so. The session we have this evening, of course, addresses some of the big questions to do with the United Nations. I'm not going to introduce everybody in great detail, but we're going to begin with Dr. Mary Martin over here, who will give a presentation of up to about 10, 15 minutes. I've tried to be very strict with people, so we get as much from you as you get from us. We're then going to move over to Peter Harvey here, who works for Rio Tinto. You're the prophets, are you? Or are you the peace, or are you both? Everything. You are, and you're also a person. That's good. you are also people. That's excellent, Peter. And then we finally move to Menaz Mustafavi, the head of the UN Human Security Unit, who we've established a relationship. Very nice to have you back here at the London School of Economics. In this particularly special room, by the way, I don't know if you notice all these photographs or pictures, paintings actually, of very important people who have been directors of the school since it was founded back in 1895. I won't give you a long history on that. But actually, always to remind people, although it's called the Shaw Library, it's clearly connected to one of the founders of the school, George Bernard Shaw. But George Bernard Shaw was fortunate enough to have a very fine marriage with a very fine woman who's at the back there, Charlotte Payne Townsend. She was an Irish woman of very great wealth and also happened to be an anarcho-socialist. Worked that combination out. Anyway, Charlotte provided the funding for this particular room, the Shaw Library, which was established just at the end of the 1930s, 1940. And one of the things that Charlotte always wanted to do, said, but people at the LSE read a lot of social science, they don't read enough poetry, they don't read enough literature. Maybe that's true, I don't know. But anyway, so it's to her memory we should dedicate this as well, because she was a very fine, extraordinary woman, as indeed was George Bernard Shaw, a rather fine, extraordinary Irishman. So anyway, with no further ado, welcome here to the LSE, welcome to this very special room, the Shaw Library, and I'm going to pass over straight away to Mary to set the ball rolling. Mary, over to you.
Thank you, Mick. Thanks very much. I'm going to talk about our report, hopefully if my voice holds out. Apologies for the croakiness, and why we think it's relevant. But first of all, we have a short film about human security, which was produced by the UN Trust Fund for Human Security, just to give you some context.
Azim, biz Today's complex and interconnected challenges impede efforts to eradicate poverty and promote shared prosperity.
In 2015,
world leaders responded to persistent global deficits in development, peace, human rights, and environmental protection by adopting a bold and transformative plan of action for the world's people and our planet.
It is so decided.
The 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development aims to shift the world onto a more resilient path, leaving no one behind. The human security approach provides a proven and practical tool in realizing that promise, and its application can strengthen country-led implementation of Agenda 2030.
Human security looks at cross-cutting issues, threats to human life, which affect their livelihoods, their dignity, and their survival.
In situations of crisis and multidimensional poverty, acting on single issues is not enough. Vulnerabilities must be tackled together, comprehensively.
Un enfoque holístico e integral donde se consideran las necesidades no como una sola, sino como múltiples.
أكتر حاجة الناس محتاجة محتاجة الاهتمام بالتعليم بالصحة الاهتمام بالزراعة اهتمام
By being grounded in local realities, human security helps ensure context-specific solutions that reduce inequalities and promote inclusion, one community at a time.
The goal is to enhance the livelihood of those most vulnerable.
Prevention is the core objective of human security. It addresses root causes, focuses attention on emerging risks, and emphasizes early action to help governments and people build resilience.
As opposed to it being an emergency every time we have drought, we want the communities to be able to adapt to this climate changes.
Because human security brings together a broad range of stakeholders, it results in meaningful partnerships that generate more impactful and sustainable outcomes.
Un travail qui se fait en équipe, un travail qui se fait de façon dynamique.
It gives people hope that things can change, even in the smaller scale. So it's not all national planning, but it's also something practical on the ground.
Scaling up this kind of comprehensive, integrated, localized, and preventive action is necessary to achieve Agenda 2030's ambitious vision.
Nagiging masaya na ako ngayon dahil nga nakikita ko may patutunguhan itong aming binubuong industriya nito.
Panalo dito na rin. Ani kawarigin. Turong iday. Ikam to akilit.
Ya siento que va por un rumbo que quería.
The wealth of lessons from human security programs in over 90 countries can help inform and strengthen roadmaps for action that ensure no one is left behind.
That gives you just a bit of some of the context for what we're going to discuss tonight. But let me add another piece, which is really about why our program exists, which is in the last 10 years, there's been a steady change in how we think about the private sector in international politics and in our societies and how visible it's become. Partly that change has been galvanized by the financial crisis in 2008 and a lack of trust towards corporations. But going further back to 2000 and some of the popular demonstrations we saw against global private capital. And partly as a result of those kind of shifts, you've seen much bigger agendas, policy and practice agendas like business and human rights and corporate social responsibility, norms such as transparency and different reporting standards, all of which tend to go towards managing what are called the ESG, the economic, social, and governance impacts of companies. Then there's a distinct strand of work by scholars and practitioners which looks more at the kind of positive potential, potential of positive action by companies. And here the UN Global Compact and the Business for Peace movement have perhaps been most significant in promoting those kind of agendas. But for those of us who are working around the concept of human security and how to apply it in various ways since the ideas of security changed after the end of the Cold War, it seemed that there was a nexus that could be explored between the idea of security as the everyday experience of people who face all kinds of vulnerabilities, whether they're physical, material, or dignity, and the implications of business operations and foreign investment, and particularly in contexts where you have fragility, crisis, weak governance, conflict, so on. And obviously the Agenda 2030, as we've seen, and the Sustainable Development Goals provides an obvious context for thinking about that nexus and elaborating a practical, ethical role for the private sector in meeting development and security challenges. The report we're publishing today is a result of a year-long series of conversations, roundtables, interviews with policymakers, companies, NGOs, and our own research in the field with communities in different locations. I'd like to thank our research partners who've been with us during a lot of that, International Alert, Swiss Peace, French Business School, ESSEC, Irénée, Build Up and Start Up, who are social enterprises, and also the Business and Human Rights Network, and Christina Bache is in the audience, who's the chair of the steering committee of the UN Business for Peace Working Group. And, of course, the UN Trust Fund for Human Security and the UN Human Security Unit and the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, who support this initiative both financially and intellectually. So the report that we've produced is a set of preliminary proposals for a framework of what we call human security business partnerships, partnerships between the private sector, government, communities, and civil society. The proposals, I suppose, are aimed principally at transnational corporations, large global businesses, mainly because we think they're an important key for unlocking change, not just at the global level, but also at local level, through their supply and value chains, the engagements they already have with communities, and through their connections to policymaking nationally and transnationally. So the aim of the framework is to suggest a new model of associative governance at ground level. The human security business partnership, they're meant to be a collaborative mechanism, and not only for mobilizing and directing companies to try a new approach, but requiring government and communities and civil society to work with business in new ways, which create lasting improvements. And the framework we've developed is based primarily on understanding what companies can bring to the table at local level. I should have put up, that's the front cover of our report. We looked at those, and the kind of attributes are sort of perhaps obvious and perhaps not so obvious. They're present. They're the local force on the ground, sometimes where governments aren't or any other form of governance. They have local knowledge, often because they're employing local people as well as expats. They have resources, clearly, but not just financial, also informational and logistical. A sort of problem-solving capacity, mentality, which is useful. They can often achieve critical mass through leveraging responses across sectors and different industry categories. And because investment cycles are often longer than, say, policy cycles or even interventions, aid or assistance from outside, there is the sort of potential for a sustained engagement with companies, and not least that ability to foster new ideas and share learning. We looked at then some of the challenges as well as the attributes that companies face in developing this more proactive role. I think it's probably quite hard for you to see all the text on there, but basically four kinds of challenges. There's the contribution challenge, how and when companies get involved, a practice challenge around what they actually do to manage issues of development and security within their own organizations, a cooperation challenge, which is about how they work with other actors on the ground, and a capacity challenge, which is about whether they have the right sets of resources and how they can deploy them. And across those different challenges, what we found were two gaps, if you like, a vertical gap, which was about a sort of disconnect between what companies subscribe to and talk about, you know, nice websites, good rhetoric at the international level, you know, they all go to Davos or they talk in the right forums. But trickling that down to the ground is problematic. So that's the vertical gap. And secondly, a horizontal gap, which is made up of lots of different things, really, but sort of where the dots don't get joined up between what companies are doing and what other actors in development and security may bring, but also how the benefits that corporate activities might bring in terms of investment and jobs and so on may have unintended negative consequences of another kind, maybe on the environment, health, or social cohesion. And also a gap, as I said, in connecting different kinds of resources to provide effective solutions. So the framework that we've come up with, it's not a regulatory framework. And everybody says, oh, God, do we really need another, you know, set of guidance principles and so on? Where do you come in? What can it bring? So just to list some of the things that we hope it can do. First of all, to encourage association and cooperation between these different stakeholders, companies and other stakeholders, leading to perhaps local responses as well as global initiatives. Secondly, to create, and this is really important, a different kind of dialogue. Often what we found was that there's sort of bargaining, there's negotiation, there's stakeholder engagement, but it doesn't really work because of the partly because of the power imbalance between companies and other stakeholders. So how can you create a different kind of conversation and much more meaningful engagements? And much more participation on the people, by the people who are being impacted by corporate operations and the potential of business. And then to suggest processes and tools which support that, and if you like to go beyond, there was a widespread dissatisfaction with corporate social responsibility. I think the discourse is moving on, but a lot of people, companies particularly, don't know how to move it on from there. So the point of the framework was to try and move on that sort of engagement. And the key characteristics of the framework, I guess, are twofold. One is the human security approach, and that means, as you saw in the film, a comprehensive, people-centered, and prevention-orientated approach, and which is relevant to all kinds of contexts, not just conflict, not just development, but all the kind of difficult times in between that we see in so many places. It's also a collaboration that's grounded in a sort of equitable idea of equity and sharing. I think the key thing for a lot of people about the human security approach is that it's bottom-up and participatory. It's meant to be about people, but it's not just about giving people things, telling them what to do. It's about mobilizing their own sense of agency and taking control of their environments. And then we've added to that, as well as the human security approach, the idea of better partnering, because I think what we've seen is multi-stakeholder partnerships or public-private partnerships are also pretty unsatisfactory. They don't really deliver. So how can you develop a better kind of relationship, a longer-term relationship and trust building? So coming to the nub of it, what does this framework look like? It has three pillars: principles, processes, and tools. And the principles, nice acronym, everybody has an acronym, LIFTS, which is locally driven, locally driven, so it's context sensitive, that it should be inclusive, allow for equitable participation. Very important, it should be future orientated. I think, you know, there are understandable and very relevant grievances often between existing grievances and history between companies and the communities where they operate. But what we're trying to do with this framework is not ignore that or say they don't matter, but say that there can be a different kind of process which is focused on building common goals and overlapping interests. Trust is a huge factor, the need to build that through transparency and accountability, and this idea of sharing, that goals and benefits and a kind of mutualization of interest should be at the heart of this new dialogue, this new kind of partnership. And the principles are really important. Everybody says, oh, yeah, well, principles, fine, but, you know, be pragmatic. But I think an agreement around principles and ethos of collaboration is really important. And then from that flow, the kind of processes that we've got there and the tools. And the processes and the tools, I mean, will change from one context to another. We're not being prescriptive about this. It is, at this stage anyway, only a set of proposals. But also each scheme around this framework will develop differently, and that's the whole idea. It's a very context sort of specific initiative. So finally, just to say again why we think there is an added value in doing this as opposed to just doing the same old things, the stakeholder engagements, the CSR and so on. And maybe go to the last one first in the reverse order. But we see it very much as working with other mechanisms. There are established mechanisms, maybe not embedded enough for a lot of people around business and human rights, transparency and so on. But I think from our conversations, we think that this can possibly complement those and work with them. But I think it's a very practical way for companies to achieve the SDGs at local level. It's about how. It's about how to engage and what to do. And this idea of a changed dialogue, a conversation of a different sort. And the good thing, I think, about the human security approach is it's not just a language. It's different from human rights. It's based on human rights. It needs human rights. But it's also a different language, and it's a methodology. It's a practical kind of action plan. And I think this is what the Trust Fund with its project has done over the last 20 years, demonstrated that methodology. And these two things of focusing on common ground, what companies, communities, and the government, where are their overlapping interests? How can they identify and where can they exploit that common ground? And focused on building something together rather than just dealing with existing problems. Focus on what might be achieved by working together. So the point of this evening for us, I think, is just to put this in front of you and have some discussion. People will say, oh, that'll never work, this bit will work, this won't. I'm looking forward to hearing what Peter says, particularly because he's the sort of person that has to operationalize it. But it's our contribution to the debate.
Thank you very much, Mary. Very good. And over to Peter Harvey of Rio Tinto. Peter.
Good evening. Thank you, Mary. Thank you. Good evening. Thank you for coming this evening. So my name's Peter Harvey. I work with a mining company, Rio Tinto. Starting with the common ground, there is complete alignment with the need to improve human security. It's a business driver for us. It affects our bottom line. We need a community that wants us to be there. We need a government that sees benefit in us operating in their country. and we're custodians of their land for a period, and then we transfer that back as we move on to another location. So it's a symbiotic relationship, and it needs to be viewed as such. The challenge is, as an extractive sector, we have a very mixed background and mixed history. So there is a common starting point of what we're trying to achieve. The complexity is how we execute that work, and we have a framework here which we just discussed, which is a great step forward. However, the conundrum is the how, and how do we operationalize it, but also who's got the capability to do it, and also then do we have a tool we can scale? So we've seen aid agency work really effectively at very small scale, but when you expand that to large-scale aid efforts, we often see the effects of power corrupting people, and we see the effect of fraud and other activities coming in that undermine the intent of those operations. So scaling things is very complex. But so I thought I'd give a couple of case studies and talk through some of my experience over the last 10 years with Rio Tinto, but before that, another 10 years consulting in the extractive sector. So first of all, let's just go with exploration. So a greenfield exploration element, something is discovered, a team goes in to look at that ore body. There is an immediate need to link with the community, and the participatory relationship, the communication starts then. And that is woven into the framework we've just heard, but that is fundamental because you don't get access to the ground without the community wanting and believing. You are going to be being ethical in your approach. And 90% of communities globally are now exceptionally well connected to the internet and will provide feedback on our performance from our history as well as our aspirations for the future. So we do get held to account by the communities. The conundrum we then have is there a connection between that community and the government? And sometimes we find quite a significant difference between the two approaches. So as a company, we link to the community, but secondly, we need to have the government to provide an investment framework and a structure for us to operate. And those two things are not always aligned, and they are not always stable. So there are events that may influence and affect the community's appetite to have us there, and there may be events that influence the government's appetite to want us there as well. So there's different variables. And if you're looking to invest in a country or in a mine, those are your variables you're looking at. And so it's a commercial driver. Do we think we have firm relationships with the community, the government, to enable us to invest and operate? So stepping back and looking at it through the lens of human security, if we go into the community and provide positive impact, there is a buy-in and a mutual symbiotic relationship. We need to do the same with the government through tax and other pieces and ensure that we have a win-win for the government's perspective as well. And that's the balance we're trying to hit. And in exploration, are very good at the community side, and then the ability for us to develop that into a mine really comes down to our government relationships, which we develop over that period as well. And so I think it's about a huge investment from a company doing that work. The challenge is we're not very good at doing regional development. We're not set up. Fundamentally, Rio Tinto's good. I could dress it up, but we're good at digging things out of the ground, putting it on a large truck and transporting it to a boat and taking it to our core markets. That's what Rio Tinto has decided it wants to be and do. We didn't set ourselves up to be a development agency. So when we're not claiming to be, we're claiming to see the importance of that work, but we need a partner to execute that. So we've partnered with the World Bank in Madagascar with a project at a port in the south of the country. But sadly, we were unable. That has not worked. We felt we created the right environment for an economic incentives to build some other economic activity beyond the mine that operates there. We've really struggled to get that off the ground despite partnering as best we could. So we're continually finding that capability to execute the development work is very difficult, especially when we bring our corporate requirements around transparency, around tracking cash, looking for KPIs that are going to be effective and all these components, because That's obviously appropriate from our investors' point of view and to ensure our governance is there, but it's very challenging when you're trying to execute in those regional or rural development projects. So there's some complexity there. On a much more positive note, the commercial sector or the private sector can help in disaster relief and other pieces. So we have helped specifically around Ebola with partnering with a number of different organisations through the Ebola outbreak to provide logistics and pieces. But that's an immediate response to a specific issue. It doesn't deal with the long-term in endemic issues associated with poverty and the challenges that affect those communities. So I'm not going to dive more into the Ebola. I'm happy to take questions on it, but it was an example, quite a unique example, where we were able to help. But I still feel we've got this challenge around how do we make a lasting impression positively with the communities into the length of not just our mind's life but beyond. And that comes down, I think, back to one of my points earlier, is that who do we partner with to help deliver that? We're not set up to do it, and we need help. And that sounds maybe a weak comment, but it's an honest statement. We're not designed for that. So we do go out, and to picking up some comments from Mary's, we need to find these other mechanisms and the other actors to work locally with us. Certainly we can provide funding and some structure and support, but we can't necessarily execute this. It's hugely complex when you start to operationalize the work. So I think, how am I going for time? Reasonable. But couple minutes. So when I look at a company and I talk to a number of different organizations, but I challenge them, where do you want to sit on a spectrum of philanthropic to hard-nosed commercial? And is there that spectrum? You can look at where you decide to invest your funds now or into the future, and where do you want to sit? Do you want philanthropic? Do you want actually driven it? And the reality is there's no right spot. It's just your decision. The philanthropic end, it may be at the extreme, can be counterintuitive from a commercial revenue perspective. However, being extremely focused on the bottom line, it really doesn't work anymore. There is a middle ground where you bring your views of prioritising investing in developing stability in the local community, ensuring that the host country's government is getting enough out of your work to make it sustainable for them and effective for them. And that's the balance. So I think when you look at the spectrum, you see it moving into the centre of being the optimum option or maybe towards the philanthropic. And that is changing. And it's changing through the effect of media, the effect of how informed our investors are about our performance. So there are a number of things that are altering where we sit on that spectrum. There's also a reality that we probably, when we have a boom in the mining sector and you have more revenue, it's easier to be more philanthropic economically because the bottom line allows it. And then when the tightening comes, a real value is one that sustains the cycle. And where do we stay during that variation of the commodity sector? So just to finish, three threads that hopefully have come through. First of all, we have a common collective goal in this space. We do need to improve human security. It's entirely aligned with the commercial drivers. To do that, we need stability with the communities, with the government, and that stability enables us to move this forward. But finally, we have to find a partners to do this with us to support it, and that's around capacity building and supporting those partners, but also building a multidisciplinary approach to these conundrums that we face.
Okay, thank you very much, Peter. And last but by no means least, a colleague from the UNHCU, who have invited us some couple of years ago to develop this program in association with Mary. Over to you, Menez, to hear your final comments. And then we'll open up for Q&A, maybe discussion between the three speakers as well. Yeah, please.
Thank you.
Welcome again.
Thank you. Well, let me begin by expressing my heartfelt appreciation to LSE Ideas for the launch of the framework report, as well as this timely and important forum on the significance of human security and its implications for global business. It is indeed an honor to exchange views with such a distinguished audience of practitioners and academics. Having listened to the rich presentations so far, permit me to frame my intervention based on the following inquiries. First, how can the proposed framework on human security business partnership contribute to and capitalize on the SDGs in which the private sector is increasingly called upon to engage? Second, Why is such a framework timely and essential to the current trends and key areas of concern to the UN system, government, civil society, and the private sector? And third, how does the work of the Human Security Unit and the Trust Fund provide the institutional support for such an initiative? As you all know, engagement between the UN and the business community is not new. The creation of the UN Global Compact, along with UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, among others, have been essential milestones in the development of global norms and responsible business practices. What has changed is the increasing recognition of the vital role that the private sector can play to unlock the transformative promise of the 2030 Agenda. To this end, it is increasingly understood that business and development success are mutually reinforcing. Subsequently, scaling up of partnerships with the private sector has become paramount to finding innovative solutions to pressing challenges. Through an appropriate mix of resources from innovation to science, technology, and finance, these partnerships offer opportunities for individuals to become employees, suppliers, and distributors, and present companies with a reliable business ecosystem to build trust and reputation, reach new markets, develop consumer demands, and increase profits. At the same time, as indicated by the Secretary General, human security is central to the realization of the Sustainable Development Goals. Whether it is the scourge of conflict, the devastation of natural disasters, or the indignity of abject poverty, our inability to respond to these challenges have led to levels of discontent not seen in recent history. Today, the rising deficit of trust between states and the international system, between governments, the private sector, and their citizens, and between the UN and those we serve, tests the efficacy of our multilateral system. Challenges such as unresolved global tensions, internal conflicts, and the ongoing prevalence of violent extremism and mass displacement have given rise to unprecedented human suffering and a resurgence of populism, xenophobia, and nativist tendencies. At a time when existing paradigms fail to address the root causes of discontent and anger continues to flare and erode the bonds of our common humanity, we are reminded of the importance of human security and the aspirations of we the peoples, which is what the Charter of the UN began with, to live free from fear, want, and indignity. As seen in the video, the human security approach calls for people-centered, comprehensive, context-specific, and prevention-oriented responses that strengthen protection and empowerment of those most vulnerable. And I will get back to this later on, but I think what is extremely important is to understand that human security is not only about empowerment and engagement of the local communities and individuals, but it's also about building institutions of governance, whether it is with governments, whether it is with civil society, whether it's with communities, whether it's with private sector. So it really is about bringing both horizontally and vertically the different kind of elements that you really need for a functioning society. So well-suited to the multifaceted challenges of our times, a focus on human security looks at the interconnectedness and the cross-sectoral consequences of current and emerging threats and their impact and different dimensions on people's lives and the functioning of societies. Such an analysis provides institutions, whether they are states, intergovernmental structures, the private sector or non-governmental entities, with the necessary and effective tools to limit the conditions under which insecurities may grow and result in tensions. This ultimately contributes to greater human, national, regional, and international security. Based on a wealth of experience in over 90 countries, programs supported by the UN Trust Fund for Human Security have made significant contributions to more comprehensive, context-specific, and prevention-oriented initiatives to achieve Agenda 2030 and the SDGs. These programs employ integrated strategies that respond to specific situations of human insecurity, strengthen social harmony, and are oriented towards the prevention of crisis and the promotion of long-term development. Partnerships with the governments, the private sector, civil society, and local communities are integral to program design and implementation. It is therefore our strong conviction that the Human Security Business Partnership Framework will further extend the added value of the human security approach and create the conditions in which local communities and the private sector can flourish and contribute to the transformative promise of the 2030 Agenda. The push to engage with the private sector is highlighted in the framework report, however, will not be easy. Diverse interests, different motives, asymmetrical power relations, and unequal capacities often lead to formal, cursory, and transactional public-private partnerships that fall short of the critical role envisaged for the private sector under the SDGs and the Addis Action Agenda. Therefore, to forge lasting partnerships and to scale up business contributions to the achievement of the sustainable development, the framework encourages new forms of association and cooperation between companies, government, civil society at the local level, creates a new type of dialogue between business and other stakeholders on the basis of shared goals and interests, suggests processes and tools which support effective and durable multi-stakeholder partnerships, goes beyond corporate social responsibility and other compliance approaches to meet growing public expectations for business to contribute to sustainable development in the SDGs. And I apologize, Mary, for repeating what you had said, but I think it's important to sort of remind everybody that that is what the framework intends to do. More than an aspiration for what can be achieved, the framework begins to provide a concrete methodology for companies and communities to work together and address not only developmental challenges, but also challenges stemming from other factors that escalate risks and impede economic growth, peace, and stability. Based on rigorous analysis that is inclusive, evidence-based, and comprehensive, the framework promotes participatory processes that examine the root causes of current and emerging threats, advances a common understanding of the risks and vulnerabilities faced by different stakeholders, defined collective action based on capacities and shared interests, and utilizes relevant tools to make collaboration work more effectively. Subsequently, it draws together the expertise and resources of a wide range of actors from the United Nations system, governments, the private sector, civil society, and local communities. This allows for seizing synergies that capitalize on the comparative advantages of various stakeholders and ensures coherence, eliminates duplication, and advances integrated solutions that result in more effective and tangible improvements in the daily lives of individuals, leading to a virtuous cycle of people, profits, prosperity, and peace. Moreover, with this focus on managing and, where possible, minimizing risks, the framework helps prevent what may initially be a small challenge from escalating into a protracted crisis. As such, the framework helps governments, the private sector, and people solve problems in ways that are risk-informed and proactive. Since human security covers multiple issues, the framework requires people with diverse interests and capacities to work together in order to improve collaboration, thereby magnifying impacts and making the best use of resources. Such a systematic engagement instills a deep determination to sustain and build upon the gains of today and the aspirations of tomorrow. And we have quite a number of experiences from the programs that we have supported through the Trust Fund to highlight this. Success in achieving human security, however, will require standing leadership, where our distinct and complementary skills, resources, and networks are combined to better manage risks and harness the potential of today and the promise of tomorrow. In a highly interconnected yet multipolar and localized world, where the root causes of challenges vary considerably across nations and within countries, the framework helps localize international and national agendas so as to identify the most appropriate entry points for collective action and ensure a more inclusive development / business trajectory. The combination of these factors which organize the Human Security Business Partnership Framework not only have the potential to address profound economic, social, political, and technological changes and challenges of today, but can also provide the basis with which to capture the positive contribution of these developments and future creations and developments. At the Human Security, we aim to utilize this framework as an extension of our long-standing tradition of multi-stakeholder partnerships, which the UN Trust Fund for Human Security has supported since 2005, but I could even say 1999, which is when the fund was established. In our opinion, the Human Security Business Partnership Framework, so well represented in the framework report and summarized by Dr. Martin, is an indispensable tool to help the international system, governments, the private sector, local communities, and civil societies to come together and significantly enhance actions by the United Nations to fully realize the transformative promise of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development as well as other global commitments, such as the New York Declaration for Refugees and Migrants, the Sendai Framework for Disaster Risk Reduction, and the Sustaining Peace Agenda. We are committed to this initiative, and we look forward to its further development, as well as its implementation by different partners in as many countries as possible, which I hope Rio Tinto will be the first. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Vanessa. We've got plenty of time for questions and answers, contributions from the floor. One hand has already gone up. Do we have a microphone, by the way? Oh, there's the microphone. Okay, well, why don't you just see the hand? We'll take two or three at a time. Gentlemen there, if you could stand up and say who you are too, that would be helpful. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you all very much. Ewan Grant, I'm a customs, tax and border control consultant, and because much of my work was in the ex-Soviet states, it's particularly interested in the extractive industries. I have seen firsthand the dark side of the United Nations and the European Commission. So my question is based on that. And I went to Srebrenica, and a lady there said, my brother and my three nephews are lying here. There's not a lot you can say to that. So firstly...
What's the question?
Yeah, the question is coming. Don't you worry. One, how many of you have seen the film The Whistleblower? Two, how many of you are aware of it? Three, how many in the audience have seen it? Four, how many are aware of it? But the main question is, extractive industries and other things, how is the UN and the industries of the Western countries, democratic, transparent, adjusting to the rise and return of Chinese and Russian companies, where they may not quite always have the same standards in relation to bribery, corruption, and environmental protection? Thank you.
Thank you very much. There's a gentleman over here sitting down, looking very comfortable there. You want to stand up, sir? Who are you?
I'll stand up now. My name is Nick Stewart. I'm a barrister. I was just interested in Peter Harvey's spectrum and looking at it from a, you know, clearly what's a fairly conventional view. You know, you're a company. As things stand at the moment, it's really your shareholders, if you like, that, you know, you primarily got to keep happy. Of course, we're in a world where with, you know, much more rapid communication and ethical investment and so on, you look at it a different way. I'm just wondering, I mean, is it more accurate, perhaps, to think of yourself, not as placing yourself along a spectrum with commercial at one end and philanthropic at the other, but in a way you are always at the commercial end, or if you like, if it's not a linear spectrum, you're always at the middle of a circle. And isn't the question how far out from the center of that circle, or how far along that line towards philanthropy you can justify what you are doing for your fundamental commercial interests, taking, of course, a longer-term view and a broader view that might have been taken in the past sometimes. But is that a fair way of
right.
analysing
Thank
it,
you
looking
very
at
much.
It?
You can take the microphone over here. Somebody sitting down had their hand up. Looks like Mary Calder to me, but who knows a bit of a thing or two about human security, I think. Mary, why don't you stand up? Introduce yourself, even though I've just done so.
I'm Mary Calder, or I'm a professor here at LSE. So I've got just three, if you don't mind, I've just got three questions. I'm not going to make a comment. I mean, it's all very exciting. But the first question is, this was very much about human development, I thought, and I really wondered, how does the language of human security help you here? I mean, couldn't we have just said the same thing, a human development business partnership? Then my second question is to Peter Harvey. I mean, how much of all of this is really about minimizing reputational damage, and how much do you think it really could be a profitable course of action to do more human security locally? And the third one, which is related to this, it seems very much that this is about attitudes, building relationships, do we need some formal regulation and some sort of more work on political institutions and politics and formal accountability rather than just partnership?
Okay, thanks, Mary. That's quite a lot of questions there and in the other good contribution. So why don't we, Mary, why don't you, and then I'll come around a second time, don't worry, keep your hands up. Mary, why don't you pick up what you want to pick up on? China and Russia, that question at the beginning.
Yes, well, good China question. Very interesting because, you know, there's often the criticism that all this is, all this sort of talk about business responsibility and so on is aimed at very Western-centric, aimed at that. I would say to that, I mean, what we're deliberately going in at the ground level because we think that's where the most need is, partly because there are all these, you know, norms and standards, partly Mary's question about, you know, regulation. I mean, that piece goes on or is there and needs to be implemented properly anyway. But certainly when you get to the ground, I mean, there are good companies and not so good companies who are just ignoring that. And we know from the Chinese in Africa and other parts of the world that, you know, the things that they should be doing, they're not even signing up maybe to the global norms, but they're certainly not walking the walk on the ground. So I would have thought, maybe it's optimistic, but I mean, the ideal would be to involve, you know, a series of companies on the ground, including Chinese. And we were talking just today about the possibility of doing that in Liberia, where they are taking over from some of the Western companies on rubber wood and so on. So I think it doesn't, you know, the point of the framework is to go in at that level and try and close that gap. Shall I...
Pick up on anything.
I suppose Mary's comment about is just human development. Where does security come in? Yes, it's about development, but I think it's more about those different kinds of threats and the ability to have a mechanism, to have a platform, whatever you want to call it, at that local level where people can, in dialogue and in partnership with the business that's there, talk about issues that are, you know, a range of things, whether it's about physical security, whether it's about development, whether it's about dignity and so on. As we know, a lot of times they're all caught up together. And that, I mean, if you take an example of where we're hoping to apply the framework in Colombia, I mean, Peter talked about you can't have human security, they can't operate unless there's stability. I mean, one of the prerequisites of doing this in Colombia is to try and agree in some very kind of remote, difficult places which haven't really been touched by the peace process that need both an economic development plan, which is what the peace process is supposed to deliver, but they also need institutions, they need policing, they need all sorts of things. So I think it's more than just a human development issue. I think it's very much about recognizing that companies also have and this is perhaps where they're most uncomfortable in your spectrum, perhaps, Peter, you know, in dealing with issues that they don't think are normally in their purview. They might, you know, be pushed to be development actors, but they really don't want to become security actors, and yet, de facto, on the ground, you know, often they are. So how do you develop some kind of model, some kind of arrangement that takes account of that as well?
Okay. Peter, are you part of the problem or part of the solution? Is it just a cover story for... reputational damage was so Mary Calder's second question.
A number of questions. So just taking them off. So I think there's good evidence now to suggest that it's not motivated purely to de-risk the reputational component. I think we have countless case studies within the business, but also I think within the sector, which are available, which articulate that if we're going to run a profitable mine, you have to have a stable environment around it. And you have to have, for stability, you need an economic prosperity at a level which enables people to exist and to have to meet their human rights, as we've outlined. And I think there is a tie there, and I think we talk a little bit about a sort of conceptual mine where if you had an asset whatever it may be, and you were to provide irrigation around it, and you fund that irrigation, and that enables agricultural prosperity to take place around that asset, that becomes your buffer to provide you with security, and in all aspects of security. And I think that is a very sensible approach. Alternatively, you build walls, fences, you guard, you arm, you escalate your force, and the results get worse and worse. And we've seen that in many sectors. So I think there's a very clear case that this isn't purely around a reputation. Now, linking the questions across to the investor base, we as a company obviously are interested in our share price, are interested in our shareholders' views, and therefore that does drive our behaviours. And if they're sensitive around exposure to physical security and unrest, then we would potentially de-risk our portfolio away from it if they're interested. If they don't, and we've recently moved away from coal for that reason. So I think the investor tie-in is there, and I think that is another component that drives it. Not only is it about the optimising the running costs of an asset by having stability around it, it's also around ensuring that we as a company provide the right investment opportunities for our shareholders. Picking up on Mary's comment around, does Rio Tinto find itself as a development actor in some situations? I think we have de facto taken on that role at times. We were uncomfortable in it, I think, would be a summary. And I think we would look to partner with different organisations to use their capabilities in that area and support their work. So I think that is our preferred mode of operations in those jurisdictions. Picking up a comment around, do we regulate this rather than allow it to be a framework that has less structure? And I think Rio Tinto would not be uncomfortable with regulation in some respects, but I think our view will be that if we are to operate effectively and build the partnerships, we will be a preferred partner to work with different companies, different countries around the world. So we see this as a part of our license to operate, part of our development of our reputation as a company that communities and countries want to do work, want to do business with. So we see it as a key enabler for our work, and hence our focus on trying to get this right in difficult situations.
Menace, you want any further contributions on the role of the UN generally?
Sure. I think that one maybe is, the genesis of the SDGs was really to look at development in a much more comprehensive way. I think that, in 2000 when we had the Millennium Summit, there was also the recognition of the need of peace, the three pillars of the UN, in order to have all of the kind of elements that is required for societies to flourish, so I would say that was the intention. I think after 15 years, governments recognized, because at that time in 2000, governments were comfortable with just looking at the development side of things. And then I think that it sort of through the years, it became very evident that you cannot have development when you don't have peace and security, nor can you have it when you don't have human rights. And these things are interlinked. And I think that this is the value that human security brings. It sort of speaks very, very clearly about the fact that in societies, if you do want to have an environment in which it is enabling, whether it is for the individuals, whether it is for the governments, and whether it is for companies, the private sector, coming from their own perspective interest, you do need to have these different freedoms there. You cannot just focus on development and hope that development is going to trickle down to human rights. I mean, you do have to come and ensure that all of these various elements are complementing each other. Now, the question is, of course, that the reality on the ground is that the entry point may be a little bit different in one country versus another country. And I think that is, again, the beauty of human security, that you may go in the entry point of human rights, if they're very open to the idea, and then address some of the questions in which exclusion, if it is prevalent in the country, is not being addressed, and sort of bring the development side of the kind of triangular situation into the discourse and into the response framework. So, and in another case, it could be development. So you go in from a development perspective, and then from the development perspective, you tell people that, listen, if you don't address the land tenure of IDPs, no matter how much you put in with regards to health, with regards to food, with regards to whatever it is, it's never, ever going to be enough to have that sort of a transformation that you need for these societies to also be sustainable. It's just, it's always going to be a kind of assistance. And I think also what is extremely important is to keep in mind that Agenda 2030 is also trying very hard to move away from a culture of assistance to a culture of actually development. And I think this is because much of the money that the UN is spending, particularly over the last decade, has been towards pretty much, you know, humanitarian response. And that, again, not addressing the root causes. And so if you read the Agenda 2030, and particularly its preamble, you will see that many of what the principles are of the Agenda 2030 are based on, again, you need to, you know, have, or which is human security. But the reason for it is because of practical realities that the UN is dealing with. You cannot have a United Nations whereby we are just going and giving Band-Aid, you know, for a thing, and if we can go in. So the idea was to be more proactive, to try to make the UN become more preventive, to address the root causes, to ensure that there is long-term development. And here, I think also the role of the private sector, I think the UN is increasingly highlighting the fact that, again, if you want to have stability, if you want to have prosperity, which all, everybody benefits from, so it's not necessarily, you know, an assistant thing. I mean, the private sector also very much benefits from having stable societies, from having prosperity in societies, because, as I said, then that prosperity can trickle down into markets, into, you know, expansion of your consumer besides building trust. So I think the UN is trying very hard to emphasize that again, this idea of ensuring that societies are, you know, prosperous, but they're also stable, that the individuals are also given that sense of dignity and worth that they need, is not only important for governments, it is also important for the private sector, and it's also important for the people. And therefore, it's not a kind of philanthropic thing. It's more a reality check. And in that reality check, I also think that the UN is trying very hard to emphasize that when you look at the amount of investment that goes into countries, foreign direct investment is by far larger than ODA. So if you, again, want to have a transformative impact, you need to involve the private sector, and in particular the TNCs and multinational corporations. And so I feel that the framework that we are proposing, what it aims to do, and again, we are at the early stages, so we intend to do this in different countries and try to be able to see how we can work. But it does try to go at the local level, but at the local level doesn't mean that the governments are not involved. So what we do in the multi-stakeholder partnerships that we have had over many programs, but in many countries as well, I mean, over like 50, 60, 70 programs, is we go in, we look at the needs, vulnerabilities, and capacities within that community. We understand what is the threats that are coming and how is it impacting in different domains of what is the human security. And then we say, okay, based on this mapping exercise and based on understanding where the capacity gaps are, we will come in based on our comparative advantage. So the private sector should not also do everything. There should be some role for the government. There should be some role for the UN system. There should be some role for the NGOs and CSOs. There should be role for the local communities themselves. But it is really coming together. And I don't think we've done that so far. I think most of the time it's either the UN and civil society that go in and try to respond things along with governments and bilaterals, or it is the private sector that goes in and sometimes picks one, you know, multilateral entity, whether it's the bank or, you know, and what actually we are proposing is that we have to get all the relevant partners that need to be at the table to be around the table. We need to establish a forum in which everybody is well aware of what the other person is doing, but also the communities are also engaged in the discussions about what insecurities they feel, because that also is where human security tries to come in, which is not what insecurities people are told they have, but also what but instead what are the insecurities that they actually feel. And you will be surprised by the diversity of opinion between what experts tell people what their insecurities are and what people say their insecurities are. And so we're trying to also make sure that the point of delivery is much more towards what people need.
Thank you very much. I'm never surprised that what the experts think and what people think are rather two different things. A more general question. I'll bring in other people. I mean, just on a reflection. How does Make America Great Again help you at the moment? I mean, you mentioned populism, rising nativism, people looking inwards, more concerned with their own issues. You know, I mean, human security in the broader sense requires cooperation, a kind of an outward view, an optimistic view, I would think. How do you think the current international environment, not just America, but broadly speaking, is that propitious? Does that support you? Or is that presenting problems? Just a question to you, Minister, just as a... You don't have to mention any government. Sorry.
No.
Be diplomatic.
I think human security, if you look at it as a preventative framework...
Yeah.
It can actually be an extremely useful, even in this current discourse,
yeah.
Because what you're saying is you're saying you're trying to look at the root causes of insecurities and risks and also taking into account the breadth of whatever those risks are. So really trying to address them so that you can really have impactful outcomes. And then that allows you to have an international or multilateral system that is much more managed, is much more based on sort of voluntary whatever rather than forced reactions. So I think that actually in some ways human security can be a very strong argument for ensuring that the multilatteral system is able to address and be resilient towards the challenges. Because, as I said, the idea of human security is to... And oftentimes, challenges actually start quite... there are global issues and there are regional issues that impact countries. But there are also issues that come from countries in communities... sometimes far away from capital. So it's actually quite good to know what is going on at the local level and to be very candid on that assessment and to respond to it.
Thanks very much. I've got a lot of hands have gone up. There was a hand over here, I think. I'm sorry, I'm going to take two or three. Yeah, sure. Keep your hands up so I can see who you are. Yeah, I've got you. Gosh. Yeah, please. If you could say who you are, please.
Thanks, Mickey. Jim Emerson, working with international NGOs. Just starting off on the concept of human security, I think it's a very good set of words. Maybe could have chosen different ones, but the fact that it brings together development, humanitarian, security, human rights agendas in one, I think is very helpful, particularly in the context of the Sahel, where I've been working for the last couple of years, where they are all mixed in. And Mary, you mentioned Liberia, which is post big conflict. So we've gone through Ebola, we've gone through the civil war for many, many years, and now the country is reasonably stable and there's a different agenda there. But working in those environments, the Sahel, the DRCs, in getting to your point, Memez, about we have a very tight agenda achieving our SDGs by 2030. In those contexts, how do you think we can best put to use in some of these more complicated, protracted, difficult countries in an accelerated way, because we've got a lot of catching up to do and there's still a long, long way to go? I'd just like to hear your thoughts on how that, how this framework can help in that context.
Okay. I got hands over here. Where were the hands over here? There's a woman over there, sitting in the chair. If you could stand up and say who you are, thanks. Hi.
Oh, hi, I'm Melissa Powell. I'm the Chief of Staff of the Global Compact at the UN. Thanks for the shout out. We're spending a lot of our time engaging companies also on advancing the sustainable development goals. In a topic like peace, it's so much more challenging for the companies, I feel like, to measure their positive impact. Mm. It's unlike climate change, where it's more easily quantified. I'd love to hear from Peter a little bit around, what are the kinds of KPIs that Rio Tinto is using to actually measure the impact that the company's having in these kinds of difficult operating environments? I think as as we heard some of the panelists mentioning, you know, the notion of being kind of conflict sensitive in your approach and not causing conflict is one thing. But if you're a company, how do you quantify that your pipeline didn't get blown up because the communities didn't get aggravated towards you? How are you able to articulate those metrics to your shareholders that continues to reinforce the business case for Rio Tinto? Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to take a few more. Oh, you've disappeared over here. I thought I'd lost you. There's somebody over here. If you could just stand up, please. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kate Roll from Oxford. So there's just one basic observation. Part of this conversation has really been around reframing human security as a problem in that it prevents TNC entry or creates underinvestment. And that's just an observation, but I think it's sort of a worth pause, maybe. I think the other thing to flag is that there's been a lot of discussion that companies don't work in areas of insecurity, and that just isn't true, right? You know, extractive companies work in conflict zones all the time. You know, there's an oil company in 2004 in Iraq had 14,000 private military contractors, right? And so we see companies responding to insecurity in lots of different ways, and generally in these sort of forms of securitization, bunkerization, and the privatization of public goods like security, water, infrastructure, roads. I work at a business school, so I understand this is a rational response to what we would call institutional voids. And I think what maybe I want to hear more about is the institutional story. This is a rational response to bunkerize. This is a rational response to close the doors, bring in international contractors, et cetera. So what are the leverage points for changing that and for sort of re-engaging with institutional development in the face of voids?
Okay, I'll take one more from the front here. The gentleman at the front, please. You've got your hand up, and then we'll have another round afterwards, okay? As long as we can get through this one. Okay, if you could introduce yourself, please.
Yes, Hugh Sanderman from LSE Ideas and also Amnesty International. This is a kind of Karl Popper question, because I think one of the tests of the validity of the kind of complex effort that you were discussing is how people react to, or whether they acknowledge, failure. Because what I want to ask is whether there's a test of failure, Peter, in what you do. In other words, if you have a mind that's set up, you go through all the complex effort to build institutions that's been mentioned here, and it sort of doesn't quite work, but you think you might be getting there, you put all the investment in, and then things start going wrong, but the dividends are still coming out, the cash flow is still coming out, and you've then got a kind of difficult decision, but it's not strictly a commercial decision. And at that point, are you in a position to say, as a company, the mine works cash flow-wise, but actually it doesn't work institutionally and it's not working in its context? And obviously, that decision's made for you if you have rubbish corporate governance like Vedanta, you know, where you end up with a Tutti Corin smelter and the police go and shoot a lot of people and it shuts down. But I'm talking really about how your process creates a decision-making procedure that might allow you to pull the investment when it's profitable, when you deem the cost and the failure around all this other stuff to be too great.
Thank you very much. That's a great question. The Karl Popper part, I should actually add, as many of you probably know, Karl Popper was a philosopher here at the LSE, appointed in 1946. He came up here from New Zealand and had a little bit of a reputation as a philosopher, as you know. But one of his best students, and certainly his richest, was a man called George Soros. And George Soros said, I made all my money by listening to Popper. So that question, I think, is highly relevant, Hugh, because it raises the question about falsifiability. The only good science, he thought, was that only the science, not that you could prove, but also that could be disproved. And I think that was the heart of your question. Anyway, enough about Karl Popper. Let's get back to the questions. But there you go. Soros was an inspired student of his. And if we can learn from Soros, maybe we'll learn something. Okay, why don't we begin with you, Menez? And if you want to pick up anything that comes up there, you can leave Karl Popper alone. It's okay.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Actually, I think maybe I'll. I said a lot.
You said a lot. Okay, round, I didn't want to
so
say
I
that.
Want
to
Mary. Have, actually, because Mary, I think, could
Mary,
also answer.
You have more to say now, Mary.
Yes,
Mary?
I think
okay,
so.
Over to you.
Gosh, well, lots of different things. I think I would start with Melissa's point. I know it was probably to Peter because he's the core of corporate representative, but we were discussing briefly before we came on that I think this idea of how you quantify, and it's sort of Hugh's point as well about failure and measurement and so on. And I think we feel that you need a whole set of different indicators and a bespoke kind of metrics for evaluating this. And in a very simplistic way, I would say that those evaluation processes have to be much more participatory, given this is a local level initiative, than they are at the moment. I'm not denying, I mean, Hugh's point is right. When you come down to the nub of it, you know, an investment decision is going to be taken in London or New York or wherever. It's not going to be taken around the mine in Nimba County in Liberia or wherever. However, I think, you know, it does possibly add a piece to the puzzle that in the sense of not just gaining social acceptance from the communities around there, but also making sense of how, writ large, any company engages with the people that it comes into contact with, whether they're as their workforce, whether they're as the families of the workforce, whether they're as, you know, first-line consumers. So that kind of idea of, you know, where your impacts are, getting it right at the local level, we felt was a gap that isn't addressed, but that with that, you need certain tools. That's why we have the tools pillar. And that includes KPIs and a different way of looking at these things. I don't think the decision-making process that you're referring to, Hugh, is necessarily going to be part of this, but maybe it would influence it. Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of comes to my reaction to Kate's point, your second one anyway, that I've understood, what are the leverage points? And somebody said before, I think it's well, Menaz made the point about it, also institutional. This is not just about nice partnerships at ground level. So we talk a lot about bottom up, but it's also top down. It's making sure that maybe through this mechanism, there is a way of connecting what goes on the ground, getting that right, with the kind of processes higher up the chain, whether they be the policy-making processes, what the government is doing in terms of development plans, in terms of human rights, in terms of infrastructure provision, whatever, post-conflict, rebuilding, but also connecting up even through the investor chain to the investor base, you know, which is obviously far removed from what's going on the ground. So it's a sort of, you know, it's a mechanism, hopefully, which at least starts to join some of those points which we feel perhaps aren't being joined at the moment.
Thanks very much. Peter, got any further comments?
Certainly. So it's a huge, great challenge. I think there's some complexity to this, which let me just give you a quick example. So let's say an asset, we discover something, we develop it, we invest a significant amount of money, but we don't like the reputational exposure or we don't even like the economics and the cash flow. What do you do? Do we sell it? Who do we sell it to? Can we find an ethical investor? You can't undiscover an ore body. So we now have an ore body sitting in a fragile ecosystem, which potentially we see a lot of downside to us no longer managing it. So there might be a decision to hold an asset and continue to maintain it because actually we feel we can't find a partner we could divest to. Without a significant increased reputational exposure. So that those conversations happen. The decisions around divestiture of an asset do consider that. The decisions about do we look at this asset today and go free cash flow positive? However, we're carrying a lot of risk. It may be processing risk. It may be exposure to a commodity we don't have a lot of confidence in. It may be to do with the environmental setting, and it may just be general unrest within the NGO community about the operating environment. Those downside risks have to come in. So you've got free cash flow positive, downside risks equals actually what is the value to the business? And therefore, that's the equation that has to be looked at. So we have our graph of all our assets by free cash flow. We also have it risk adapted to bring in other overlays of risk. And then there's an appetite consideration of what are the investors consider important or not, or within that. And then there's a decision to hold, divest, or expand. So those are specifically influencing investor decisions. And I take great solace in understanding, seeing that happening within Rio Tinto. We have a low threshold for reputational exposure. We're very conscious of wanting to be in a good stock to invest in, and therefore the views of international NGOs and local NGOs are important to us. I would differentiate often a lot of the international pressure is not informed by the local voice we've talked about. So there is some disconnects with the reality on the ground often to what pressure we're on. And it comes back to a previous conversation about the Trump era and other things. I mean, the world of misinformation and social media means that information travels so quick, so there's an element of reality and then also dealing with perception, which is adds to the complexity of how you view an asset and how you value that asset. So that covers aspects of that. When with respect to KPIs, how do we monitor those variables? So we do heat maps. We create heat maps of community interest. The problem with the community challenges we have is that they kind of simmer along and you don't know you're actually building goodwill or you're building issues, and then suddenly it jumps out and impacts you. So we monitor the impacts, the block, whether we have a manifestation or a blockade or some description. We monitor that, but we also attempt to be more proactive, and we will do monitoring of price of food prices and changes of that, which we know is connected to bringing hardship, which can follow through. So we have some lead indicators we would touch on, sometimes for impacted by us, but often maybe other factors as well, but we're going to be the victim of those if we're not careful. So there are some proactive indicators. They're not perfect, but we've built those up, and again, it takes time to invest and build that picture for that area. Mm. And there's the comment around time. So I think this is a fundamental challenge. If you were to bring in a new car, you'd want to test it slowly. You don't want to test it fast. You want to test the new components, put it together. You want to give yourselves time, similar like a medical drug. You want to allow it to mature and be confident in its ability. If we suddenly pressure test this framework, we're going to maybe find ourselves at odds. And certainly, coming back to one of my comments earlier, if you scale this up too fast, I worry. I think I've worked a lot on small-scale programs that have been wonderful, and you know the people, you've got a lot of confidence. When you scale, you really struggle. So I do think the time frame will have a significant impact on this, and I worry we try and go too fast.
And I think we're going to have to take a last comment from you, because we get to 8 o'clock. We are going to have, by the way, a reception afterwards. There are drinks and nibbles at the back where you can mingle and speak further to the speakers, but I'm conscious of the time, so this will have to be, I think, the last contribution.
I think on the question of scalability, and then I will also answer the gentleman's question about how the UN is dealing with Sahel and other issues, and CAR, I think, was the other one. Not that I'm an expert on either of those areas, but on the scalability, I do think that from our experience, at least, what I would suggest is that when something works, principal actor that is responsible for scalability should be the government, and it is often the government. So we did a program in Egypt, in northern part of Egypt, in Minya district, and this district was not really a priority district for the government and many governments of Egypt over the years. And so at some point we came in and we actually, and I think you saw the person from the local Ministry of Development there, and we came in and we sort of responded with this very comprehensive framework that involved the government, the UN system, NGOs, the communities. In that environment, there were no TNCs, and it actually led to, you know, as small sort of enterprises that were developed. Anyway, what I think was extremely important was for the government to see that something that they felt it was extremely difficult to respond to actually did have a very multiplying sort of response framework that could be quite positive for their also reputation, because I think that is also the other side. It's not just the private sector, it's also governments. You know, so all of us have a reputation, and also the UN. I mean, we all have reputations that, and even NGOs, I mean, everybody has a reputation that they have to really try to be cognizant of. So I think that when it is successful, you will be surprised at how government takes ownership and they start replicating it in other places. And that is exactly what is happening in Egypt with regards to this, what they call the Hayot program there. So I think scalability, if we're successful, we should lead, you know, we should get the government to take the lead, and where appropriate, again, we have the multi-stakeholder partnerships that are relevant within that, because that's the other part of it, as you know, and other people know very well. I mean, even within a country, the contexts are so different within the country. One place is very different than the other place, and the partners are different, and the challenges are different. On the question of Sahel and CAR, I mean, there I would say very quickly that I do believe, and I think that the Secretary General, Gutierrez, is trying very hard to take leadership on these issues. There is a Sahel support plan. We're actually going to be supporting developing a human security framework for the whole Sahel region and how we address all the interlinkages also that exist within the region. With regards to CAR, I think that, I mean, very recently, I don't know if it was yesterday or 2 days ago, there was some sort of a peace agreement. But again, I do think that the UN is trying very hard, and particularly this Secretary General, to reform the system itself. So we do have this much stronger preventive diplomacy. That's why you have DPA and DPKO and peace building all under one chapeau. You know, we have the development system all reporting to the to the Deputy Secretary General, and we have the RCs who have now become not sort of standalone entities that are supposed to look at the big picture of the challenges within a country. So I think that hopefully, and it's not easy also in the UN to reform, hopefully with the ambitions that the Secretary General has, we will have also a reform structure in which we can engage with the private sector in a multi-stakeholder system, which he's very committed to developing. So I think that yes, I mean, there's not enough time and there's many challenges, but I do think at least this Secretary General is trying very hard to be proactive and engaged and find solutions to the best of his ability and the offices of the UN.
Okay, thank you very much. Before I move a vote of thanks and invite you to come and have a drink with us, I wonder if I could just make at least one announcement. The LSE does many things very well, but one of the things we also do is hold a festival every year. The LSE Festival will be running from Monday the 25th of February through to Saturday the 2nd of March. It has a number of wonderful sessions there, one or two which I'm involved in, but I want to give you a flavour of what we're going to provide. Pessimism and the state of the world, just to cheer you up. How to remain sane in the age of populism. Are we heading towards a digital dystopia? Conspiracy theory as truth. It gets worse. What does it mean to be British and who defines it? Well, we'll find that out on the 29th of March. And we also have Putin's Russia, art and conflict. And I'm also giving a lecture which is called Whatever Happened to the Revolution, LSE in the 1960s, which should be good fun. I'll relive a few political fantasies there as well, I suppose. There are also two very excellent exhibitions. I just want to draw your attention to those. One is called Give Peace a Chance, from the League of Nations, great institution, to Greenham Common. That will be in the LSE Library Gallery, and also LSE 69, which again is an exhibition about the 1960s here. I was told by one director of the school, who shall remain nameless, we want to forget about the 60s, and I said, I don't want to. It was the best years of my life, but there we go. Anyway, just to broaden that, and there's a pamphlet outside, so please get a copy and try and get along to that. It shows that the LSE does more than just teach. It does many, many other things. And one of the things it does, and one of the reasons LSE Ideas has been so successful, is precisely not just because the people in LSE Ideas, but because we're also within the London School of Economics, which I think has a great tradition of public engagement, as we have seen here this evening talking about this. So I'd like to thank Mary, I'd like to thank Peter, I'd like to thank Menez, and I wonder if you could put your hands together in good LSE fashion. So thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. Terrific. And you don't get a free drink in every institution, and you won't necessarily get it here again. So I'd grab what you can get at the back. Thanks again, everybody.